Today's Veterans Radio program is a salute to all the men and women who have served aboard the Big E. That's right, the Enterprise, both CV-6 and CV-65. Our salute will be today.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Yeah, good morning. Oh, it's a beautiful day in Ann Arbor. Yeah, I know it rains, but it's always a nice day in the Midwest. And we're getting a little bit of that weather that's been coming around across the country. And today we're going to be talking about the weather. We're going to be talking about being on the ocean. We're going to be talking about the longest aircraft carrier in the fleet, the Big E. That's right, the Big E, the Enterprise. Ooh, I can't wait to have Barrett Tillman, author of over 40 military books, 40 plus military books. You know, the other day I saw him on the History Channel, and the week before that I saw him on the Military Channel. And it's really cool, way cool, when you see these people that we're going to have as guests, and there they are on national TV. Okay, well, I want to get started as soon as possible, so we'll be right back right after this very short message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University by combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Play that, folks, as I remember at about, maybe 8 years old, black and white TV, and hearing the strains of that, Victory at Sea, man, you knew that program was going to, I forgot who was the narrator. He had a real great voice, real deep voice in there. By the way, if you happen to know who the narrator was of the Victory at Sea, please give us a call, 1-877-573-7825. I'd sure like to know that. And right now, to who I have on the line, Mr. Barrett Tillman. Barrett, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, good morning, my friend. It's nice to be back. And I just happened to remember that the narrator was Lloyd Graves.
Oh, you know it all, Lloyd Gray?
Yep.
And did he ever... Was he a movie star or what? He was.
No, it's a really peculiar situation. I got curious about him years ago. Did some online searching. Apparently, he hardly did anything else in film. He had a small role in the Gregory Peck film about the Korean War called Porkchop Hill. And other than that, I can't find any additional credits.
Can we get any of the segments of the Victory at Sea series? Can we get that? You can get just about anything on the internet. But do you know of any way that we can get that and look at some of those?
Yeah, as far as I know, the entire series is on disc, and it's probably available from a variety of sources.
So just use the old Google, right? That's it. I didn't have any Google back then, but it was so cool because that V would come up from nowhere with the ocean. And the way they did that, the rolling of the ocean and the music, and then that V, I have goosebumps right now just thinking about it. And not only that, but I have goosebumps because I have been researching for the past, about 6 weeks, on the Enterprise, the carrier's Enterprise, the first one, the CV-6, and now the current one that is deployed, the CV-65. And I have Barrett with me. He's going to help me talk about that particular carrier. That's right, the one that's currently being deployed. It is the longest carrier in our fleet. And, you know, it hasn't, many times, folks, well, you know, I don't want to say this. I'm going to go right to Barrett. Barrett, how many times has that carrier been slated for decommission?
Twice that I know of. Previously, she was going to go away after the prior deployment, which ended, I think, in 2010. But then the Navy looked at the operational cycles and how long it's taking to place the new Nimitz or post-Nimitz class carriers in commission, and they cited they needed to trot out the 65 boat one more time. So she's due back from this current deployment, I believe, in September, and will go out of commission in December.
So right now it's on deployment. Where is it being deployed?
She's in the Persian Gulf part of the world. I don't know where she is specifically today.
You know, I'd like to ask one question. Now, here you are, a historian and an author. I'm just going to kind of backtrack a little bit. Why are ships called she? am I walking in a minefield here?
Well, tread lightly, my friend. Nobody seems to know for sure. I think one of the more credible explanations is that until very recently, that is in the 1970s, there were no women aboard warships, at least aboard U.S. Navy warships. And sailors, being the kind of guys they are, got to the missing feminine companionship and decided that the next best thing was to consider the ship they were aboard as female.
Well, I guess that answers that, folks. I've often wondered that. Well, getting back now to the Enterprise, it's 51 years old, and it's kind of like when you get older. And you know, it's harder to get up out of bed in the morning. It takes you a couple of hours to kind of get up, and then, you know, and then you're fine. So the Enterprise has been refitted. Tell us about that.
Well, the main thing to keep in mind about the current USS Enterprise is that she's the world's first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, and that represented a huge change in naval construction. She was commissioned, that is, she entered fleet service in 1961. So, as you say, she's been part of the Navy for 51 years now. and very much a revolutionary rather than an evolutionary design. She is powered with eight nuclear reactors.
Eight of them. That's just hard to fathom. Eight nuclear reactors, folks. Eight of them. And, of course, they have to have nuclear engineers on board, right?
Oh, yeah. That's a big part of the ship's company, is managing and operating that many reactors. And I was aboard the ship as a guest of the skipper, Boomer Hamilton, before she left Norfolk in March. I was there in February. And he explained in some detail that because Enterprise is the only ship of her class, even though five others were contemplated, that means that after 50 years, there's no spare parts. So Boomer is extremely proud of his machine shop. He said they can make almost any of the specific spare parts that are required to keep not just the reactors going, but the ship generally. And I got a look at their operation, and they have everything they need to keep themselves going while they're deployed.
Now, how did she look when you last saw her? How did she look? Did she look like maybe it was time to go and settle in somewhere, or did it look ready and fit and here we go?
No, just walking up the pier with my escort, I thought she looked great. Fresh paint. The ship was a beehive of activity, as you might expect. Sailors were busy loading supplies and preparing to get underway. There were no aircraft aboard because aircraft complement, which is Carrier Air Wing 1, was going to fly out from Oceania once the ship is left. But I thought for a 51-year-old operating warship, she looked pretty good.
What is her aircraft component?
Typically, carriers anymore have about 70 jets and helicopters, although it tends to vary from one ship and one air wing to another. The most significant mission-oriented aircraft in naval aviation these days is the originally McDonnell Douglas, now Boeing FA-18 Hornet strike fighter, which is, as the name implies, is a multi-mission airplane. But Enterprise and every other operating carrier also has E-2 Hawkeye surveillance aircraft. It has SH-60 helicopters that perform both anti-submarine and search and rescue activities. So it's quite a variety of machinery there.
Yeah, that was another thing that I've talked to guys that have served on carriers. How many of them fall overboard? And they said, no, you got these nets out on the side. But apparently every now and then, one of them gets blown overboard by the jet blast. Do you know anything about that?
I would be very surprised if a jet blast would blow an airplane overboard, because they're pretty heavy machines.
Well, no, I was mostly thinking of sailors.
Oh, sailors.
Yeah, sailors.
Yeah, that can happen, but it's rare. The training and awareness that these guys and gals have is impressive to see, and it's fairly unusual for a carrier to come back from a typical 6-month deployment without everybody who was on board when they left.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
I know. But I'm thinking, you got a long way to fall if you're on. I just think I don't see any fence, see? And I don't see any fence. And when I don't see any fence, I'm going, oh, boy, you could just, go right over the side.
Well, it's not as if it's a sheer drop like the Grand Canyon, because circling the flight deck, for most of its circumference, is what they call the catwalk, which is a depressed area that allows people to go fore and aft without walking on the flight deck itself, and that also provides access to the interior of the ship. So if a sailor did get knocked off his or her feet, he would fall into the catwalk before he actually went overboard.
Well, I was talking to some sailors who served aboard a carrier, and they said just below the bow, and you can look at the photo, and just below the bow, it's an open area. And apparently, that's where a lot of sailors go when they're off duty, just to watch the jets take off right over them. Wow. Boy, that would, man, would that be exciting. Oh, yeah. Hey, how about it, Navy guys? Bye, Navy guys. If you have a comment to make about being on a carrier, why don't you give us a call at 1-877-573-7825. That's 1-877-573-7825. And now we're talking about the tradition of the Enterprise. The first Enterprise carrier was the CV-6, and that was decommissioned. And is that anywhere to be found, or has it been sold for scrap?
No, very, very sadly, the World War II Big E was sold for scrap in 1958, and the last of her hull was cut up for sale not long before the current Enterprise was commissioned in 1961. There are portions of the World War II ship still visible, including the stern plate with the Enterprise name, and that's visible at, I think it's a community ballpark in Riverdale, New Jersey, and then there are a couple of anchors at naval museums and other portions of the structure around the country.
I know, it's so sad to see, but it would take such a Herculean effort to keep these ships from rusting and falling in such disrepair that they couldn't be visited. Cause just to be able to walk on that particular ship would have been, oh boy, it would have been so exciting. But getting back to, okay, let's get back now to here we are, 2012. We have a global presence. So when you look at aircraft carriers, they're part of these strike forces. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, an aircraft carrier does not operate independently. It's not just steaming around the ocean looking for a chance to launch Hornets and Prowlers and Hawkeyes and whatnot. It's the center of what today is called a battle group. Previously was known as you say, Bob, a task force. And the carrier always will be accompanied by cruisers, frigates, or destroyers, and usually there's one or two submarines affiliated with that group, as well as underway replenishment ships. And I know any of your Navy veterans listening will recall what they call UNREPs, underway replenishments, and that's vital to keeping ships at sea forward deployed, as they say, for sometimes weeks at a time.
And how has that worked? How effective has that been to when we want to show might, when we want to go out and get the job done, that we have these battle groups?
The Navy likes to say that every aircraft carrier, depending on its class and size, is approximately 4.5 acres of sovereign American territory. And operating in international waters, it means that American air power in the form of carrier-based aircraft with tail hooks on the back end of them can project power, if need be, almost anywhere on Earth, because approximately 70% of the Earth's surface is ocean, and consequently carriers can travel almost anywhere that the situation requires, and not so much launch aircraft indiscriminately, but what the Navy calls showing presence. It's a way to show the flag, as it were, and remind potential troublemakers that just because Iran or Iraq, whatever, any potential national enemy is several thousand miles from American shores does not make them immune to power projection from the sea.
Now, when you look at back in the days before nuclear power, you had to have service ships. You had to have service boats that gave them fuel and supplies. So, what does the Enterprise do on this particular deployment? You got 4,000 personnel. Do they get serviced, or do they actually carry all the produce and supplies and what for that entire deployment?
No, they even a larger nuclear powered carrier such as the Nimitz class ships, which is the most common carrier we have now, will run out of food or jet fuel, or if it's a rare situation with strike operations, eventually they'll run out of ordnance. And that's why the underway replenishment force is so vital to sustaining task forces at sea. And the difference with a nuclear-powered ship, of course, is that its reactors can operate for years at a time without running short of fuel. Now, when a ship such as the Enterprise or any of the Nimitz's requires refueling, that's a major, major undertaking. It can be years refueling, and consequently, that's why the Navy prefers to have typically 11 deployable carriers because of the time and the expense required to refuel those nuclear reactors.
How many carriers that do we have in the fleet?
11.
11. And they're mostly the Nimitz class, is that correct?
Yeah, correct.
Okay, so we have it's not longer, but we have what? More deck space?
Well, certainly the CVNs, the nuclear-powered carriers, are larger than the predecessors. After World War II and jets became the wave of the future, the Navy recognized that carriers had to be bigger and heavier to operate not only the post-war generation of jets, but because carriers have a service life of 40 years or more, the Navy has to dust off its crystal ball and look decades downstream and try to anticipate the size and the weight and the characteristics of aircraft that are unknown at the time the ship is commissioned. So, it's a major, major evolution in prognostication. And the first generation of what were called supercarriers was the Forrestal class that entered service in the late 1950s. And those ships were fairly long-lived. The Forrestal served us well. They were based on combat experience from World War II, so the concern of operability and survivability is always a factor. And Navy people from the 1960s will recall that three aircraft carriers suffered catastrophic fires. The World War II vintage ship Oriskany in 1966, and then the lead ship of the Forrestal class, the Forrestal herself, had a major fire in 1967. And then Enterprise, the current ship, another one in January of 1969. So it's instructive that as disastrous as those fires were, and loss of life and aircraft and materiel, all of them returned to service in fairly short order, and it really speaks well for the Navy's institutional ability to conduct damage control.
And we will cover that later on in the program about the fires. I'm saving that for the last because it was so dramatic. But what I also, right now, getting back to the ship, and when you look at the flyer, I did include a photograph of the model, and you could take a look at that. At that hull, and I understand that you said something about the deck, that it was at a certain angle.
Yeah, in operating the early generation of jet aircraft off World War II carriers, which are what we call axial or straight deck, the accident rate just went through the overhead because you're operating much faster aircraft and heavier aircraft than the World War II propeller types of machinery. And the accident rate was horrendous. So to give a brief idea, you have a long rectangle, and the jet airplane is approaching from the stern, from the aft end. And partway up the deck, beyond the arresting wires that snag a tail hook and bring an airplane to a stop, there's a series of woven steel barriers. But more often than anybody like to contemplate, jets either would miss the wires and smash into the barriers or through the barriers, or else would land over the top of the barriers and impact the planes that were parked forward. And one of my valued tailhook friends was Wally Schirra, the late astronaut.
Oh, yeah.
Wally entered naval aviation right after World War II, and he said in those days, you either you had an arrested landing or a major accident. And consequently, the British Royal Navy came up with the inspired idea of angling a portion of the flight deck roughly 10 degrees to the left, to port, while the main portion of the deck just continued straight ahead as per normal. What that angle did for you is give you an unobstructed landing area so that if the pilot did miss the arresting wires on the angled part of the deck, he just added power and accelerated and went around for another pass, and there was no big danger of hitting the parking portion of the flight deck, and it just did marvels for the safety and efficiency of operating jet aircraft at sea.
Is that being maintained today, that angle?
Oh, yes, yeah. Every conventional aircraft carrier in the world, whether it's American, French, the Russian designs, the British, has an angle, unless it's specifically intended to operate helicopters and the new and current generation of what they call jump jets, that is the vertical takeoff and landing machines like the Harrier.
I saw the Harrier this weekend, Sunday, at the Yankee Air Museum in Ypsilanti, Michigan. They had a great air show. By the way, next year, folks, you want to plan your vacations around that. And they had a Harrier. Boy, that thing made a lot of noise. Whew, man, that really made a lot of noise. And if you've got something that doesn't require that length of runway, what's going to happen to like the H.W. Bush that's being built? This huge, huge monster. What is going to happen with all that, and also future carriers?
Well, the future of conventional carrier aircraft is currently in a state of transition. The Navy, for better or worse, has committed itself to the next generation strike fighter. It's called the F-35, built by Lockheed Martin. And that's a modular concept. It's going to be built in three primary models. The A model is the land-based, the Air Force version. The B model is for the Marines, the U.S. Marine Corps, and the Royal Navy. And that's the vertical takeoff and landing version. And then the C model has the capabilities, or was intended for the capabilities to operate from carriers such as the Enterprise and the Nimitzes and any follow-on ships. The trouble is the Navy really, really, really screwed up in the design of the F-35C and only belatedly discovered that the tail hook is too short to engage the arresting wires reliably. And that's because the Navy, like the Air Force, is obsessed with stealth technology, and the stealth aspect of an airframe can be degraded seriously by protuberances. And as I've learned from talking to people in the test and evaluation community, the F-35C, meant to operate off aircraft carriers, was not properly designed, so the tail hook is not reliable enough to engage the wires. And there's only one way to fix that, or two ways actually, but one acceptable way to the Navy, and that would be to redesign the rear fuselage of the F-35C, which is a huge expense. And either that or accept the degraded stealth availability with a longer tail hook.
Well, so Barrett, I've got to cut for a break right now. Hold your thought on that, because I want to get right back to that. It has to do with the future. We'll be right back with Barrett Tillman, the Big E, everything you want to know about carriers now and in the future, right after this short message.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat. The Medal of Honor. The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Chaplain Joseph O'Callaghan, the wounded and dying, led firefighting crews and directed the jettisoning live ammunition from his stricken ship. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
Freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I've been in the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
O'Callaghan was serving as chaplain on board the USS Franklin when that vessel was fiercely attacked by enemy Japanese aircraft. Calmly braving the barriers of fire and twisted metal to aid his men and his ship, O'Callaghan groped his way through smoke-filled quarters to the open flight deck and into the midst of violently exploding bombs, shells, rockets, and other armament. With the ship rocked by incessant explosions, with debris fragments raining down and fires raging in ever-increasing fury, he ministered to the wounded and dying, comforting and encouraging men of all faiths. He organized and led firefighting crews into the blazing inferno on the flight deck. He directed the jettisoning of live ammunition and the flooding of the magazine. He manned a hose to cool hot armed bombs rolling dangerously on the listing deck, continuing his efforts despite searing, suffocating smoke which forced men to fall back gasping. O'Callaghan inspired the officers and men of the Franklin to fight heroically and with profound faith in the face of almost certain death and to return their stricken ship to port. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat.
Yeah, that's Anchors Away. And just like the Enterprise, we've got some of the equipment here just a little bit old. So bear with us sometimes, folks. But we do get it on. We do get it on the air. And with me is Barrett Tillman, author of 40-plus books on military. And right now he's telling us about the Big E, what we call the Big E Part 2, the CV-65. Barrett, you were talking about this F-35, I believe it is, and the impact and how that tail hook is not long enough. How could that be?
Well, that's the $64 million question, because aside from Lockheed Martin, the Navy's Air System Command is involved in design and development of naval aircraft, and then the test and evaluation process is ongoing. So, as I recall, the problems with the F-35's tail hook became evident early this year. I think January, February, And Lockheed Martin is on record as stating that the problem will be fixed late this year. The one news report I just accessed said they expect that to be done in the fourth quarter of this year. But naval aviators have been just scratching their heads ever since the problem became known, wondering how in the world is it possible that the most significant future platform in naval aviation got so far in the development phase before so crucial a problem became evident.
And? What did they say?
Well, I have not seen any definitive statements as to how that happened. Obviously, it's a considerable embarrassment to the manufacturer and to the Navy, but the whole F-35 program is, as far as I know, the largest, the most expensive military contract ever. And it, as people in naval aviation say, it has TBTF tattooed on its forehead. It's too big to fail, and the Navy probably will continue throwing money at it until something is fixed.
Well, do we get to get our money back?
No, I don't think you and I are
in line
for a refund. No.
Okay, folks. No, don't go writing your senator and all that. But there have been a couple things. I'm looking here for your notes that you had on one individual that ran aground. And so the Navy kind of sweeps this stuff under the surf. What happened to the guy who ran aground?
That was then-Captain Kelly, who put the Enterprise aground in San Francisco Harbor in, I think it was the early 80s. I don't recall the date.
You got 1982 on here.
82, okay. Well, he made four stars and retired as a full admiral.
And the Navy also had an admiral of a pilot, okay, who shot down a United States Air Force airplane in 87. So they made this another guy an admiral. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't have personal knowledge of that situation, but I do know that it was a what they call a joint operation, a multi-service exercise involving the Air Force and the Navy with live fire air-to-air missiles. And for whatever reason, the Tomcat pilot thought he was cleared to fire at, a drone, an unmanned target. And actually, he was tracking U.S. Air Force F-4 Phantom and blew it out of the sky. Fortunately, nobody was killed, although I think the Air Force pilot, the front seater, suffered permanent injuries.
Wow. Okay, I know, folks. Don't go writing us now. You're blasting the Navy. No, but I think we need to know about these things. That, like everything else, there is human error, and it needs to be addressed. And in this case, we won't get into that. Let's get back to the design of the Enterprise. It had four rudders, and it gave us something. What do they call this here? A cruiser-like hull. And the question I want to ask you, Barrett, what is flank speed?
Flank speed is the, no kidding, maximum speed of any ship, not just carriers or warships. And as far as I know, the flank speed of most U.S. Navy vessels is considered sensitive, if not classified information. I don't know the top speed that the 65 boat can make, but it's somewhere north of 35 knots probably.
Wow.
And a knot is 15% more than a statute mile.
So I'm thinking if I'm looking at this right here, this ship is so big, and yet it can go 40 miles an hour. Wow. That's mind-boggling to think of that.
Well, it's even more impressive when you consider that most aircraft carriers, depending on their configuration and load, gross out at something over 80,000 tons. So that's just a whole lot of mass and momentum.
Think of that going down the freeway.
At the off-ramp, right?
And there's a stop sign. I don't think so, folks. Okay, she's had a storied history in a lot of different combat situations, starting with the missile crisis. I know, folks, because I was involved in that. That's right. They flew this youngster down to Florida, and there we were, sat in tents for a month getting ready to jump into Cuba. And along with that was the Enterprise. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that was in context of the Soviets' decision to put ballistic missiles in Cuba. And as I recall, there were two types of missiles installed there. This was in October of 1962. So there again, we're coming up on a significant anniversary. But the situation was considered unacceptable by President John Kennedy, and he imposed essentially a naval blockade. The wordsmiths and the lawyers were playing semantic games. They called it a quarantine instead of a blockade, because a blockade technically is an act of war. But Enterprise was part of a large naval task force patrolling the waters around Cuba in the Caribbean, and flying patrols, monitoring Soviet vessels that were bringing additional supplies into Cuba, and also looking for Russian submarines. So it was a pretty tense situation for a while.
And it also, the Enterprise was Vietnam deployed. What role did it play there? And tell us about that.
Well, Enterprise, like so many other carriers, made multiple deployments to the Tonkin Gulf during the Vietnam War. In the Enterprise's case, the first of, I think, six deployments was in 1965-66, and then she deployed yearly thereafter through 69, and then she underwent a long overhaul and came back for two more cruises in 1971-72, and then the final one in 72-73. So she was one of those who came early and stayed late. And the process in those days was for carriers reporting into the area at the start of a deployment would warm up with strike operations over South Vietnam, and then a little while later would move from what they called Dixie Station. They would steam north to Yankee Station off North Vietnam, and launch missions into a series of geographic areas, the most heavily defended of which, of course, were Hanoi and Haiphong.
Wow, folks. She's known as the fightingest ship in the Navy. And, boy, that is so exciting to hear about that. Very quickly, we only have a couple minutes before we go to the next break. Tell us about WestPac. And how that is with the Enterprise WestPac deployment.
WestPac is Navy shorthand for the Western Pacific, and ships that are deploying mainly from the West Coast, but not always. Enterprise, after all, is an East Coast ship based in Norfolk. They will steam either east or west and arrive in the Western Pacific for the majority of a WestPac deployment. And in that regard, the carriers are available for contingency operations. For instance, in 1958, there was the Matsu Kuimoi crisis with the mainland Chinese threatening Taiwan. Or we also frequently have a ship permanently based, they call it forward deployed, in Japan. And the Japanese do not like to have nuclear-powered vessels in their country, so now that the oil-fired ships are going away, I don't know how that's going to work out. But WestPac is a generic term that alludes to any operations in the western part of the Pacific Ocean.
Well, thank you on that one, Barrett. Barrett, you get yourself a glass of water and get your breath. My gosh, you've been on the air now for just about 45 minutes. We'll be right back with Barrett Tillman, author of over 40 military books, and he right now is talking about the USS Enterprise, CV-65. We'll be right back.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother. My wife. My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO, part of the Ave Maria Network. Yes, I wanted to get that one in. God of our fathers. And with me right now is Barrett Tillman, author of over 40 books on military, just whatever you want to find, folks. Barrett, tell us, how can somebody get a hold of a list of these books? And because Christmas, I know it's a few months away, but you're going to want to be thinking about that, or birthdays. Barrett, tell us that.
The easiest way to access any of my books is through Amazon.com, and not only are all my current books available there, but so are all the ones that are out of print. Those are available from other booksellers who are linked to Amazon. Otherwise, if folks are interested in visiting their local bookstore, most of my, not most necessarily, but many of my current books are displayed there. Barnes & Noble is certainly the largest of those, and the present book is just called Enterprise, America's Fighting a Ship and the Men Who Helped Win World War II, and that's the first to last account of the CV-6 carrier.
Folks, I really encourage you to go and check this out, especially, and you know, when you're looking at the military channel or you're looking at the history channel, and there comes Barrett Tillman, and you heard it right here on Veterans Radio, all the things that we talked about today, and we've still got a few more minutes, so I saved the most dramatic for the last, the scariest incident that could happen on a carrier, or probably just about any ship, is fire. And they've had fires. As Barrett said earlier, there were three fires. Why don't you give us a little background leading up? And the question I want to know is, you had fires one and two. What steps were taken to prevent fire three, which was the Enterprise, and what happened? Give us a little background on that, Barrett.
In October of 1966, the Essex-class carrier carrier Oriskany, which was of World War II vintage, was conducting flight operations in the Tonkin Gulf. And a couple of sailors on the hangar deck mishandled some flares that were going to be, it's what they call an upload-download sequence. They were offloading flares from aircraft that had flown the previous night and storing them in a locker. One of the sailors accidentally activated one of the flares. He pulled the lanyard that started it burning, and not knowing what else to do, he threw it into the storage locker, slammed the door, and that's where the flare ignited and set off, I think, more than 100 others. And it was a very, very serious fire with heavy loss of life. So the Navy recognized the need for additional training and firefighting capability. So the next fire occurred aboard the Forrestal, as we mentioned, in 1967, and that was not due to any fault of handling ordnance or anything. It was a flight deck auxiliary power unit that had inadvertently been allowed to vent its exhaust on some ordnance on a parked airplane, and that set off another major fire, although the Forrestal was fully repaired and returned to service in a reasonably short time. And then a similar situation occurred on the Enterprise on January 14th, 1969. And in that episode, the result was 27 sailors killed, something over 300 were injured, and 14 or 15 aircraft were destroyed. So the Navy formed a board to examine the common factors to each of those, and really in the case of the Forrestal and the Enterprise, it was simply a matter of having to be aware where the vents of the auxiliary power units that start jet aircraft were pointing. Having said that, though, the U.S. Navy institutionally has always been extremely attentive to firefighting because, obviously, a fire at sea, by its nature, is an extremely serious problem. And the Navy has very seldom lost ships to fire in peacetime, and even in the height of World War II, we lost no aircraft carriers to shipboard fires because of the training and the state of readiness of those sailors.
Did we come close with the Forrestal?
No, we didn't. It was a serious setback for the ship's deployment schedule, but the damage was almost entirely confined to the flight deck. Although when you have ordnance such as 500 or 1,000 pound bombs cooking off, obviously you're going to get holes in things, and portions of the flight deck had to be patched or replaced as a result.
Well, that's what I did see a program. In fact, I think you commented on it. I think you were on that program regarding the fire on the Enterprise, and it just looks so scary.
Oh my gosh! From the ships escorting the Enterprise, it looked really, really bad because you had just almost a volcanic type of flame and smoke engulfing most of the flight deck. But as I recall, the crew brought the fires under control in a very short time. I think it was less than 20 minutes, and then the flames were completely doused after that. So a very, very fine testament to the damage control of the United States Navy.
Yes, that certainly does. And there was more training, as you said, that took place after this to combat fires at sea, and I suppose that's probably true today, even with the size of the carriers that we have. That I look at the George H.W. Bush, and that is so huge. How can they protect that? Is that I guess I'm kind of lost here. I want to go somewhere with, because these accidents do happen. And were they mostly sailor error?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any serious shipboard fire in the past several, or I should say the past few decades, that was largely attributed to material or equipment failure. And it's the same thing we see in aviation. The main cause of accidents is pilot error rather than, say, engine failure or structural problems.
Right now with me in the control room is Dale Thronberry. Dale, being a pilot, what do you have to say about all that?
Oh, thanks a lot. I never had the opportunity of landing on an aircraft carrier because I only flew helicopters. I take that back. I landed on a Navy ship in the South China Sea. But I agree with what you're saying about the biggest fear that pilots have is fire. Even with today's probably higher technology as far as fire suppression, fire is the thing that frightened us the most.
Yeah, with chemicals and foams, and I'm sure all that has been improved since the time that the Enterprise, about 40 years ago, I think, something like that. And Dale's going to be just about in a minute telling us what's going to be next week. But Barrett, I want to conclude. I want to thank you very much for being on the program. And you know what? I think we'd like to do a Enterprise 3. There's still more information. I'm looking here at things that I have we couldn't even come close to. And I don't want to rush through it. But I do have one question that I've want. Barrett, I hope you can answer this. And I see that before the pilots take off, their right hand is up on a hand. I don't even know if it's a handle. It's just aperture or a projection that they hang on to while they're being catapulted down the deck. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, there's two handles on the canopy frame of most carrier aircraft, and that's for the pilot to grab hold because the aircraft is trimmed. Dale will understand the concept there for nose up, and the engines are at full power. The catapult fires. It's a very powerful steam catapult, and it flings that aircraft down the catapult track, and it goes from zero to probably, I'm going to guess, about 120 knots in a matter of seconds. And at that point, once it's flying, the pilot puts his hands on the stick and throttle. But otherwise, it's what pilots and air crews call an e-ticket ride.
What was that again? It's called a...
an e-ticket ride, like at Disneyland.
Oh, okay. So, folks, when you look at the Military Channel and the History Channel, and you're seeing these jets just before they take off, watch where that right hand is. It's up there, and it's a little bit of trivia. Should win you a beer every now and then. Well, speaking about a beer, Barrett, you need to go and... Well, maybe it's a little early on a Saturday morning, but... you certainly came through again for Veterans Radio. I want to thank you. Dale wants to thank you. Nina wants to thank you. All the listeners want to thank you. You really earned your stripes and stars and whatever else. I want to thank you very much. We'd like to have you back.
I'd enjoy that.
Thanks again. Okay, signing off. Wow. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Hold on here, folks. And here we go. That's our theme. And Dale's going to be next week. Dale, real quick.
Real quick, next week we're going to be talking about the last Zero fighters, first-hand accounts of World War II Japanese naval pilots, and our guest hopefully is going to be Dan King. This is really looking at World War II from the other side.
And did you leave the flight at, what was that, 120 knots? And then helicopter?
We took off from zero and maybe got up. We had the transitional lift was about 40 miles an hour.
Okay, folks, this is Bob Gould and Veterans Radio. Stick around for the Ave Maria Network. We'll see you next week.